Can this be the students from the master program?
Uh-huh.
And they're second-year students.
Uh-huh.
We have, in our class, we've been reading biographies of monks and nuns.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And I think we read already Ajahn Mun's biography.
Okay. Okay, unfortunately, we don't have a proper biography yet.
Yeah, we're doing talks, Dharma talks about them.
Okay, you know, I could probably give you a file that it's sort of a work in progress that is, it's really embarrassing just how long it's taken to do a biography. That might be interesting for you if you do the biography, because I think it's quite, you know, it's unfolding, and I put the monk who's been working on it is a perfectionist, so that every time he gets a good whatever he writes, and then everybody else likes it, and he lets it sit for a while. He goes back and looks at it, and then he redoes it. So that's been going on for 20 years now. So actually, this last spring, because I've been pestering him for years, and I said that we had an agreement in the spring that if he wasn't going to do it and finish it, then he would give me all of his files and I would get it finished. Mm-hmm. I'd make sure it was finished. And so we made an agreement and said that if by the end of the rainy season, the Vasa period, if he wasn't finished or felt that he couldn't finish it, then he would give it all to me. So I said, okay, I'm going to take it all from you and I'm going to finish it. And so then he, that really motivated him, so he's working on it. I talked with him at the end of the rains, and I called him up and he said, yeah, I'm motivated, I'm working. So hopefully we'll have a decent biography of Ajahn Chah.
I think I attended a committee meeting for Master Hua's biography of the times after China.
Uh-huh.
So I think we only have biographies written when the day that he was in China. But it was a committee, and we never were able to get anything. It would also be 20 years.
Yes.
Or maybe 50.
Yes, that's it's a similar situation. But I think committee is a bit harder to deal with. Anyway, go ahead. Whatever. So you're Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Pei,
Ajahn
Yi.
Okay,
yeah. And the actual course that it's under, what is the course?
It's part of what we call a Buddhist hermeneutics class. Mm-hmm. And the purpose for this class is we're looking at the lives of spiritual practitioners, mm-hmm. and looking at markers and indicators and their motivations and their practices.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay.
Yeah. So we started with the biography of the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're looking at both the Mahayana. here. So we see that there's the work meeting. And so the community in the morning does work?
Well, we begin at 5 a.m. With chanting, morning chanting, meditation. So we chant usually for about 20 minutes or so. And then an hour meditation, and then we break at close to 6:30. And then it's kind of general sort of clean up, and then there's a light breakfast at 7 o'clock. And then 7:30, as you saw, I distribute the chores for the morning. And then everybody heads off different places to work, and then come back at a meal is at 10:45. So we come together for the main meal, and we have our meal, clean up after that, and then everybody goes back to their dwelling places for the afternoon, and people can practice or study on their own. And then there's a there's an informal tea time at 5:30, and there'll usually be somebody here, myself, or one of the other senior monks, so that we're available for questions and answers. So if anybody's got questions in practice or meditation or whatever, then we're available. So it's about 5:30 to 6:30, and then there's a bit of a break. 7 o'clock evening chanting, meditation, and then we break, and people go back to their dwelling places again. So that the day is somewhat, you know, pretty simple. On a weekly basis, and there's once a week on the lunar observances, those are the days that we go on alms round into the. Actually, we do four different alms rounds. It's like one in Ukiah, one in Redwood Valley, one just along Tonkai Road, and one up in Willis.
One up in where?
Willis.
Is the same group of monks, or the monks divide up?
Oh no, we divide it up. So there'll be three will go to Ukiah, and then two to Redwood Valley, because then you can fit them in the van, and drop two off in Redwood Valley, go into Ukiah, go on alms round, come back, pick up the monks from Redwood Valley, and then two will walk along Tonkai Road. There's some of the local people who will make offerings, and then two will go up to Willis. And there's always changes.
Stay on the topic of biographies and lifestyle.
You don't have to.
Okay. Well, I was just thinking, in Ajahn Lee's biography, he talks about, I think it was Ajahn Lee's biography, he talks about when he was living in Bangkok, studying at the monastery there, and he was thinking about leaving Bangkok and joining the forest tradition. And he talked about how he felt like the lifestyle there in the city wasn't supportive of the practice that he was working on.
Yeah.
And he also, I might be confusing his biography with Ajahn Tate, I'm not sure, but I think he also mentioned that it was a little awkward leaving because some of the monks in the city sort of looked down on Dutanga monks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm curious, is the lifestyle here sort of like what a Dutanga monk would be like, or is that something different, or what is
that? Yeah, I mean, it's definitely way closer to the Dutanga monks or the forest monks. One is just the, well, we're definitely in the forest. Mm-hmm. Keeping the monastic precepts, which in Thai Buddhist culture or the monastic culture, then it's a small minority of monks who actually keep all of the precepts. I would think probably very similar to CTPB, monks and nuns keep a lot of the training precepts. And if you go to other Chinese monasteries, you know, how could they look like this?
I've never made that
one. Well, oftentimes it's like that. And certainly often, for the monks here, yeah, they have no idea what... they think this is standard.
Mm-hmm.
This is normal. But the way that monastic life is lived in the city or in the villages is very, very different. It's pretty lax, pretty laid back. Everybody has, there's different precepts that we have. The simplicity is not there. It's actually a very big support for our practice, and it creates a community. Ajahn Chah in particular used the monastic form for the basis of community life. So it creates a strong community and community feeling, and for a lot of monasteries, and it's pretty much everybody fending for themselves, which isn't that beautiful. Yeah. So that, and then the emphasis, of course, on meditation is minimal at best in most monasteries, say in Thailand. That emphasis of training, a lot of it is study and ritual, and that's what the forest tradition is really kind of a very conscious attempt to try to get out of that kind of rut, really. And because also there's a premise that in the cities and towns, the emphasis on ritual and ceremonies, on study, the premise is that it's not possible to be enlightened anymore. There isn't any such thing as enlightenment. So you better just study the teachings and make merit, and then hope to be reborn when the next Buddha comes. and the for the forest tradition, the premise is very different, in the sense that the teachings that the Buddha gave are teachings that are realizable here and now in this lifetime, and if you put forth effort and you apply yourself to the teachings, to the practice, you can realize the fruits of the practice. And even if you don't realize it, it is still possible, and people have done it in the past, and people are still doing it in the present. So that's what these great teachers like Ajahn Mun and Ajahn Chah and Thay and all of these teachers are a testament to the viability of the teachings.
And I also, just in the use of this term, Dutanga monk, I hope I didn't like say anything. I wasn't sure if it was like some kind of slur or something.
Oh, so, no. No, I mean, the Dutanga monk is considered, like in Thai culture, then you, it's like a, in the way they, in Thai, how they pronounce it in Thai, Tudong. Mm-hmm. And like, so that, and usually the association, the Dutanga practices are 13 Dutanga practices that increase the simplicity. Mm-hmm. But then colloquially, if you're a Tudong monk, what it usually means is that you're wandering. So you'll wander as a Tudong monk, and you'll just have your robe and your bowl and a few requisites, and then you'll wander from place to place, and you might find a nice place to practice for a shorter or longer period of time, or you give some teachings to the, you're like a wandering mendicant monastic, and that's considered something. Even in Thai culture, there's a kind of a mystique about that. So it's held up as something good. Mm-hmm. I can remember myself going as a wandering monk on Tudong, and stopping in at some of the village monasteries where you know, need a place to stay, have a bath, and the old abbot in the small village temple, and oh, I can remember when I was young. You know, so it's like, you know, fond memories, or for the lay people, it's sort of something, oh, that's something really, really, really good to be doing. So there is a certain element but then it's also, once it becomes, that's why I say, like, for the in Thai culture, where if you actually settle down and stay and keep those Dutanga practices, then it tends to be a challenge to the status quo of the monasteries and the village structure. So then, it's a two-edged sort of a sword. And but it's something that we've been doing here in America. It's like, were you here for Ajahn Yanipa's talk? Or, yeah.
I'm here.
You're here when he gave the talk, giving his experience.
Oh, no, we were here when he was mentioning that he was going.
Oh, okay.
So I was wondering
how he made up.
I was thinking about him when it was raining.
Yes, they got soaked. Totally, completely soaked, which is it's part of the deal.
Mm-hmm. So there were two monks that went wandering.
Yeah, that was right at, when was that? That was a few weeks ago. So they got back about 10 days ago, maybe. Mm-hmm. And so, they were going to start in Fort Bragg, and they were going to walk up to a small road that heads over to Lega. And as soon as they stayed at a layperson's house in Fort Bragg, and then she took them to restaurant for a big breakfast and to send them off. And then they, as soon as they left the restaurant, it started dumping rain. And they kept walking, and they got really soaked that day, and then it was kept raining. But then during the night, the wind picked up. It was these howling winds and rain, so they were totally soaked. And then they ended up scrapping their plan to continue along the coast. And then there's another road that goes out to Laytonville. They just get out off the coast and get into the hills a bit, where they're a bit more protected from the, at least from the wind. And so yeah, they got completely soaked, but they ended up doing okay. Somebody took them when they got to Laytonville. Somebody saw them and saw how soaked and what they were doing, and as monks and noble. So then they took them to a laundromat, and they were able to dry out all of their gear, and then pointed them out to sort of the bleachers in the sports field of Laytonville is protected from the rain. So they spent the night there.
Did they have like backpacking gear with them, like a tent or something?
They made their own stuff.
Oh.
They made their own stuff, so they made kind of a tarp, like a small tent that, as long as it wasn't raining too hard with not a lot of wind, it would give some protection. But then the weather changed, so they did that for 2 weeks this year. There's this one of the monks who just completed his fifth rains, which is sort of kind of a marker, the finishing ones, sort of like apprenticeship. You're able to start to do things, step out a bit more. And so the Ajahn Yanico, the senior monk, offered to take him off for a bit of an experiment or adventure. So they did that. But last year they walked, the two of the monks walked from here up to the Branch Monastery in White Sand in Washington. So that was, it was almost 2 months of walking, about 6 weeks, 7 weeks. And the really interesting thing is that they in all that time, because they went on trail every day, because you don't have money, you can't store food, so every day you go on trail, and there's only one day where they didn't get any food at all, and it was because they misjudged the distance to the town. They didn't get there until afternoon, so it was too late to go on Omdram, too late to, because we can't eat after afternoon. So. And there were some days where a little bit thin, or where you got kind of strange food, but they got food every day. Yeah. People, and it's not as if it's, and you go north from here and follow the coast and go up Northern California and Oregon. There's not a lot of Asian communities. Certainly not. I don't know if there's any Thai restaurants along the way.
So it's pretty rare to get food every day if you're on the walk. So it's pretty rare to have food every day if you're on the walk.
No. They got food. They got food.
Right, but is it normally do you expect not to get food?
Well, it's good not to have any expectations at all.
That's true.
Especially especially when you have no means to fulfill that expectation, which is part of the practice. Mm-hmm. It's really part of the practice of that, where you're, because the mind is always wanting, you know, some comfort, some security, so then that's a direct challenge to that tendency.
Do you have to educate the local people about arms around when you go from town to town?
You do, in the sense that when you go on alms round, then oftentimes what you do, you just either walk slowly or you'll stand some place that is unobtrusive, in the sense of not getting in the way of people. But you can't ask.
Yeah, and you can tell them what you need.
Right,
how
exactly.
Do they know to give you food?
Well, so it helps when you're dressed like this. You know, in the sense that, you know, and of course, being in America, Americans will, without ask, you know, who are you? What are you doing? It's not like, because often, say, like in Britain, people are too polite to say, oh. It works to our advantage in that way. So people will ask, and then you can say, "Oh," because sometimes what they say, they'll somehow assume that that you want money, mm-hmm. and then they'll try to give you some money. And you say, "No, we don't accept money. What we're doing is we can receive food for our daily meal," and then some people will sort of say, "Oh, I don't have any food," and walk away. or they'll say, "Oh, could you wait here and I'll go get some food?" Because usually if you stand with your alms bowl, then you usually stand somewhere where there is a you know, some kind of a grocery store or something somewhat nearby.
So. It's certainly very admirable to go on So just wondering, for people who died in the first time, what were their experiences like in terms of how it helps them with walking on the path?
Well, I think that's just incredible simplicity. Mm-hmm. There you realize, oh, I don't need all the props that I thought I needed. And that gives a lot of reflection on this. Oh, what's the difference between my desires and my needs? So that's a helpful reflection. Then there's also the aspect of when you make yourself as vulnerable as that, you tend to meet people who take an interest in you, or and then who show an interest in your lifestyle or in your choices and in the teachings. So then you get to give some instruction, or there's some conversation that happens, and so it tends to actually give an increase in faith and confidence to the teachings, because they're you're seeing people who are directly benefiting from them, and they're not people who would normally come to a monastery. It's quite fresh and immediate in that way. So it's a big support in the practice that way.
Is there a requirement for the monks in the forest tradition to do that, or is it more optional?
It's optional. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes the monks kind of, you know, want to try it. Mm-hmm. But it's not required. It's like those Dutanga practices. Mm-hmm. All of those Dutanga practices are a voluntary thing.
Right.
And so, like Ajahn Chah used to. He would encourage people to go wandering. Sometimes he would discourage people from wandering.
Mm-hmm.
Remember one monk went to ask for permission to go wandering, because oftentimes it's like, it can also be a mask to follow one's restlessness and dissatisfaction. I'll go on Tudong. and I didn't remember one time, yeah, you can go on Tudong. Pack up all your gear and move out of your kuti and just walk around the monastery. And then there was another time, there was a Westerner who he was an incredibly restless character. And he came to Ajahn Chah, and he was only three reins, so normally Ajahn Chah wouldn't give permission for a monk to go off on his own and go wandering. And he came and asked permission to go on Tudong, because he was just bursting with restlessness. And Ajahn Chah said, yeah, I think that's a great idea, that's really good. He said, but, if you're going to do Tudong, you have to do it properly. And this monk Buddha was ready to agree to anything, so long as he could get out of the monastery.
You know how I feel sometimes.
If you're going to do it, then no taking rides, just walking. No, not taking any rides, and not staying for any place more than three nights. You have to keep wandering. He was ready to agree to anything, and so then he went off on Tudong. And then again, it was a few weeks later, and it was the hot season as well. And then a few weeks later, I saw that the monk came back, and I said, Ajahn Chah, he tricked me again. I was miserable. I'm so happy to be back.
Never want to go.
Out walking in the hot season, just not being able to take a ride, and not being able to settle down in a nice cool forest, and you go walking. So. Yeah.
And Bichun is there walking. Hmm? And Bichun is there doing this practice.
Yeah. Anyone?
Bichunis.
Oh, Bichunis.
Yeah.
That I'm not sure. I think there's more, in the vineyard, there's more restrictions in Bikshuni vineyard. In England, the Sila Dara, in Indian art, in England, in our tradition, we don't have any Bikshunis, but we have a Sila Dara order, which is their precepts are based on the Bhikkhu and Bhikkhuni precepts. So they have, I can't remember how many, about 150 rules that we created a training out of. And they go regularly. on Tudor. They do it in England, in Wales, Ireland. I think the nuns in particular I've heard from different nuns. They really like going to Ireland, wandering there. I think part of it is because of the Catholic roots in. And there's still a very strong perception of the religious seeker, monastic in Ireland.
What is the ordination process from someone who initially wants to become a monk to the ordination process?
Usually what happens is somebody comes here and they want to, they're interested and they want to take ordination. So normally they would stay here for several months and 3, 4, 5 months and just see how they fit in, see how they make out with the routine, fitting into the community, and then if they make a request to take training as a beginning of the month, then they will take 8 precepts and be in white. So you see the two men in white, they're anagarikas, which is a postulant, and they will train in that form for about a year, and then if they want to go forward, then they make a request. And when they're in white, then they're still able to handle money, to drive, to cook, so they'll be very influential in helping. Are looking after things, and then if they're, and it's a community decision, so it comes up to the, it's not just me, so that because they're always very well behaved in front of me. So it's so it's a very much a community decision, and everybody has a chance to everybody feel comfortable with taking this person on for novice training, and if everybody's happy, then they'll take their novice precepts.
Is that like quite democratic vote, or how does it work? Like
consensus. So that we need to come to some kind of consensus, which is actually how the Vinaya is structured on consensus, as opposed to, like, if something was in the Buddha's time, and you look at the Vinaya historically, if kind of the worst way of making a decision was through, if something got really bad, then it was put to a vote. But otherwise, it was always consensus, and you have to sort of be willing to work with those within those parameters, and until there is a agreement. So then they would take their novice precepts. That's sort of that's the two at the very back are novices. They're in brown, but they have fewer precepts. So they have 10 precepts as a novice, and other sort of course they're entering into the form of looking more like monastics. So then there's a bit more refined training happening. They wouldn't be in the kitchen anymore. They wouldn't be driving, and you can't. be handling money as a novice. So then, and that would be for another year. And then, and similarly, they make a request toward the end of their year to take the bhikkhu precepts. Then they would, and if the community is in agreement, then they would go forward and we would do the bhikkhu ordination for them. And then once they've taken their bhikkhu precepts, then they make a commitment to 5 years staying with the teacher and staying under the training of the monastery, which doesn't mean they're here all the time, but it would be taking me as a preceptor, taking the community as their kind of home base. And I'll usually send their third year, almost I give them the opportunity to be away from Abhayagiri, experience monastic training in another place, whether it's in Thailand or England or Canada, where we have brass monasteries, and that's an opportunity that they have a year away, and then you come back, finish their fourth and fifth years. So that generally that's how the patterns work.
What happens after 5 years?
It depends. Some will stay on here. Some will say, like this monk here, he finished his fifth year last year, and so he stayed on for his sixth year, and then he's going to go to England in the spring and live with one of the monasteries there, one of the teachers there. Different monks would do. There was a monk who just left, just finished his fifth year, and he's gone to visit his family right now, Tankovalo. And he will travel to Asia with me, and then he'll stay. I'll leave him in Thailand.
Are you going to pick him up sometime?
<Let's> see.
No expectations.
How often does a community reject somebody who wants to go for it?
Usually the process is how do you say it? It's self-selecting, in the sense that I think most people feel either uncomfortable or feel they don't fit early on in the process. But it does happen but it's usually at the time of asking to become an Anagarika or being an Anagarika and wanting to become a novice, and then sort of like that. Now this really isn't working. So it happens from time to time, but it does tend to be self-selecting. Somebody is because it's a pretty tight training, really. You don't want to make it, tight in the sense of propping yourself up and saying, oh, you have to be like this. But it's more like, no, there's expectations of keeping precepts, keeping standards, having a form that you have to live by. And over time, then people get a feel for themselves. I don't think I can do this or want to do this. But we have rejected people.
your secret?
How do we do it? Well, you know, I think part of it I think the Theravada is maybe a bit, and then the forest tradition of Theravada is, it doesn't have a lot of culturally bound forms in the sense of it's pretty simple. Mm-hmm. So the simplicity of the lifestyle helps to keep it focused on the a monastic lifestyle with a training that's grounded in the historical Patimokkha precepts. Mm-hmm. So that people feel that they're plugging into a historical root that has been nourished through time and has expressed itself in different cultures. So I think that's part of it. Part of it also is, say, our own, there's a certain uniqueness in our own history in the sense of, because most of us who are abbots in this lineage, and certainly are here to buy Gary, then we all spend a lot of time in Thailand, in Asia, so that we're exposed to the training there, we're exposed to the language, and then we're able to keep a balance of what is it that's useful for the training, but doesn't have to entail a lot of cultural expressions. And of course, the forest tradition is, because it's fairly simple, then it doesn't make it that difficult. I think also have a teacher like Ajahn Chah, who was he had a good feel for what works for human beings, and there was a good balance of sort of effort and a certain relaxing, enjoying the lifestyle as a monastic. What comes to mind is some of the there's a few. Because, Ajahn Chah is unique in Thai tradition as well, in terms of the numbers of Westerners that are out there. And somebody like, I think of Ajahn Mahabhu attracted quite a lot of Westerners. And he's a big, highly respected teacher in Thailand, and is a great teacher. But his own temperament was one that was, he was very forceful. And so it tended to attract that or emphasize that. And so that that hasn't translated into a tradition that's been able to come to the West. Mm-hmm. There's been a few monks who have stayed on in Thailand but it hasn't really. It's only just sort of starting to happen now. There's a monk who lived with. He's about my age, and somewhat junior to me. But he's been with Ajahn Mahabhu for a long time, and now he's setting up in Virginia, mm-hmm. And he's got a good balance, so that I think it'll start to draw people. So there is a need to have a certain balance of because I think in the West, in America in particular, it's such a competitive culture. That if you just take an outer form that emphasizes striving, then they just tie themselves up in knots. And it doesn't kind of work for them. And it becomes quite neurotic, actually. So you want to have a strict form. You want to have, but it also has to be compassionate as well. So that there it needs that balance. And so that there's both the cultural expressions as well as the kind of temperamental expression that needs a balance. So I think that's something that we learn from Ajahn Chah, and I think that's helped to allow it to sort of take root in Western countries.
Do the American monks have a culture shock when they go visit Thailand? Is the tradition so? Is a culture?
It's not. Yeah, I mean, it is and it isn't. Usually if they've got a good grounding in the... And it depends on the person as well. Because some monks, it's just too much for them. But in general, because also, again, the kind of the history of our lineage is we have a monastery that was set up during Ajahn Chah's lifetime in Thailand by Westerners and for Westerners, so that it has a kind of a blend that it fits into the culture there, but it's not full immersion. So it's a good introduction. And then we have access to all of the main monastery of Wat Pa Pong and branch monasteries, and so that there's a nice mix and exposure that takes place. I think one of the things that is there is an interest in American culture and American society that younger people want something that's got some form to it, that is also has a basis of renunciation and you get a lot of, you see the people that are come here to train to ordination, and mostly younger.
I have a question. Like, in a biography, like they always talk about, like you have your mind about Buddha,
mm-hmm.
Buddha, okay. The method, and they talk about this, and also like. In the morning, the lecture you gave, just the morning talk, you also mentioned like the awareness, and it's kind of like last time the Ajahn Sumedho, he went to the CTB, he also talked about taking refuge with the awareness.
Yes.
Take refuge with the awareness. So, my question is, how is that to take refuge with the awareness? How to be aware of that? Everything when you're in daily life, in daily life, you say you work and then you go chanting and then you still be very careful in your mind interaction with the sense objects.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's that function of awareness happen? Where is that awareness? And how to be aware? Is that kind of feeling? And then how to connect with your practice?
Well, that is the practice. That is the practice. Mm-hmm. In that sense of being able to... Because that's the most fundamental quality of the mind that is needed in terms of, if you're going to be able, if you're going to keep precepts,
mm-hmm.
you have to have a foundation of awareness. If you're going to develop your meditation,
mm-hmm.
you need to have a foundation of awareness. If you're going to really cultivate wisdom and discernment, you have to have awareness. If you're going to have loving kindness or compassion,
mm-hmm.
you have to have awareness. So, the awareness is really the foundation that we build our practice on. So that sense of learning how to establish a recollection.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you know, the word that we use in English for awareness or in Sanskrit, it would be smriti.
Smriti.
In Pali, it's sati. I'm not sure what it is in Chinese, but they're
recollection?
Yeah.
Mindful.
So, yeah, mindfulness. Mm-hmm. The roots in the Pali language of mm-hmm. sati is actually, it has the same root has the meaning of memory.
Mm-hmm.
So memory, recollection,
mm-hmm.
Not forgetting.
Mm-hmm.
So that having that recollected attention is a basic foundation. But then also mindfulness is when the Buddha speaks of mindfulness,
mm-hmm.
he rarely has mindfulness stand alone. It's usually in conjunction with a word called sampajanya, which is means like clear comprehension.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's a clear comprehension of the circumstances that one is. Like mindfulness doesn't, it's not an isolated phenomena. Our mindfulness,
mm-hmm.
or it isn't just focusing in on an object.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually paying attention to the circumstances that we're in. It pays attention to the reaction
mm-hmm.
and the things that we're receiving from the senses. So that mindfulness starts to expand out in terms of its function.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also something that is not passive.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that is, there's an engaging. Whenever the Buddha teaches more fully about mindfulness, and particularly in the Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse on establishing the mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
There's a stock phrase that the Buddha describes mindfulness, and the first one is around effort, atapi, so that there's an ardency, there's effort, it's engaged. It's not just passive and letting things happen. So that's an important quality when we're thinking of mindfulness. There's that sense of recollection, sati, atapi sampajana satima. So the effort, clear comprehension, recollection, and then the last is a pulling back from the likes and dislikes that entangle us in the world. It's a function of mindfulness. So those are you get a bigger picture of mindfulness. And that's the quality of awareness that we want to start establishing in the heart. That's how we use, say, like using Buddho is it's like you're using a mantra that helps to hold the mind, but it's a tool as opposed to the purpose of the tool is to help establish that quality of awareness and attention. And the Buddho is just a helpful tool to give you some, because the mind needs, the nature of the mind is that it does need an object. Otherwise, it's going to find its own object. If you don't make a choice for it, it's going to sort of wander around and it's going to find something to engage in. So that Buddho is a helpful tool that the Thais use. But it's also a recollection that helps to establish a certain faith or confidence, because it's a name of the Buddha. Mm-hmm. And so that you're establishing a certain faith, mm-hmm. or relying on a certain faith. Oh yeah, the Buddha's backing me up here on this one. Mm-hmm. And then also the literal meaning of the word Buddha or Buddha, mm-hmm. is one who is awakened. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, but waking up, because we drift off to sleep all the time. Mm-hmm. So it's a part of the practice of establishing this constellation of qualities, mm-hmm. that help the mind be bright and clear. Mm-hmm. That is very much a part of the forest tradition, in the sense of that emphasis on awakening and presence of awareness and attention, being the one who knows, because mm-hmm. that's a literal meaning of Buddha, is to say the one who knows, but then it's also being the one who knows. We have the opportunity for us to be that knowing.
To you. You being the one to know, so that you don't have to react.
Yes, exactly.
You don't have to react to as a dislike and like, but you know.
You just know it. It doesn't mean there isn't like or dislike there, mm-hmm. but you know it. Mm-hmm. That's the difference of the awakened mind and unawakened mind, is that the unawakened mind keeps following those likes and dislikes. An awakened mind can see that arise, establish itself, and pass away. And mind is the same.
So why awareness can be the place we can take refuge? Is it why?
Well, because, I mean, it's like usually we take refuge in something outside. Mm-hmm. You know, we tend to objectify something. When we say, I'm going to take refuge in the Buddha, then you think of a Buddha image, or you think of a historical Buddha, or you think, I'm take refuge in the Dhamma, and you think of, okay, there's all of the texts, and there's all of the teachings, all of these things I have to remember. Or take refuge in Sangha, and there's all those monks and nuns out there. but taking refuge in awareness means those qualities of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, we internalize them, and bring them into the heart itself.
Mm-hmm. How do you not objectify this awareness?
Pardon?
How do you not objectify this awareness?
Oh, that's where the Four Noble Truths are so important to incorporate as one is practicing, because you look, if you objectify awareness, you're going to suffer. And that's, and it's that, you start paying attention to what is it that leads to suffering. And it doesn't have to be suffering, miserable, you know, weeping and crying. It's sort of suffering in the sense of dis-ease, discontent. It's kind of stressful to hold that as an object. And so then when you see that, that kind of dis-ease or that stress, then it can be relinquished. So that's that. The use of the Four Noble Truths is not just a nice teaching. It's so important to keep learning how to internalize that teaching in one's training and practice. And that investigation of, you know, what is it that I'm experiencing that is really unsatisfactory? What is it that is creating a sense of disease, discontent? Where is that arising? What's behind that? How to relinquish that? What's the feeling that comes when I do relinquish it? So that those Four Noble Truths are not an end point. They're something that you're internalizing and using in your meditation practice and in your daily life. I think that's something that the, you know, in terms of the forest tradition, Dutanga tradition, they put a lot of emphasis on those two qualities. Awareness, puru, being the one who knows, Four Noble Truths.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to much more than that. And that, I'm certain Ajahn Chah, Ajahn Man, you know, one of the things that Ajahn Chah said made a big difference for him, and I think it's similar to Ajahn Tate, as a teaching from Ajahn Man, who, and it's probably one that he taught on a fairly regular basis, but just reading and listening, for me, listening to Ajahn Chah, teaching that really hit me very strongly, very powerfully, was Ajahn Mun's instruction to pay attention to the difference between the mind and the objects of mind. No, it's more like the citta, sort of the mind itself, or the mind base,
mm-hmm.
and the aramana, the objects of mind. Because our mind tends to be engaged in the objects of mind.
Mm-hmm.
And we forget to come back to the base of the... And that's where, again, that being the one who knows, coming back to the core. Because that's the function of the mind in its
mm-hmm.
fundamental basis, it's just its ability to know. It's just a fundamental knowing. So that being able to pay attention to the difference between those, and you realize, oh, that, yeah, the objects of mind are really not a decent refuge, but the mind itself, the heart itself,
mm-hmm.
That's an appropriate reference.
That is not a distracted mind.
That's an object. It's the mind going out.
It's the peaceful mind. It's your home. The peaceful.
The nature of the mind when it's clear and still and not going out to its object, is that it is peaceful. But that's all part of the investigation, is also starting to recognize, you know, there's times when you take the peaceful mind as an object and try to hold on to it. And then it becomes a source of suffering. But we can create suffering out of anything.
I was wondering, listening to Bobby's question, is Ajahn Mon's biography describe a constant vigilance, like watching the mind, so fierce.
Yes.
But meeting you guys, you're so relaxed and calm. I'm just wondering, in terms of practice.
Well, one of the things you have to recognize or realize is that Ajahn Mun's biography was written by Ajahn Mahabua. Yeah, so he has that ferocity, and so that was what was most important to him. And actually, Ajahn Mun was quite ferocious with Ajahn Mahabua at times. It wasn't all the time, but that's Ajahn Mahabua's temperament. It also when the Ajahn Mun biography came out by Ajahn Mahabua, I mean, a lot of people were really excited, appreciative, grateful to have it, because it was great to have that. But then there was also a substantial faction of Ajahn Mun disciples who said, "This isn't the Ajahn Mun I knew."
Voice about Master
Hua. Exactly. You live in it. Yeah. So that there was an alternative biography was written. Like another biography was written.
There is?
It's not translated into English. But it gives another picture. And I think that you know, any great teacher is not monochromatic. To understand that the presentation of Ajahn Mun is conditioned by the temperament of the person who's writing. That's very difficult because that's how Ajahn Mahabua experienced, because that's who he is. And that's something that that doesn't mean it's just sort of wildly biased because of his defilements and attachments. It's just the nature of human existence, and that's one of the things in the I don't think it's in the canon, but I think it's in the commentaries, where they actually say, like, the only person who is actually able to, say, rise above or relinquish their personality and their personal characteristics is a Buddha. Even the great arahants, they all had they carried their personality into the expression of their awakening. Mm-hmm. So that, and that's normal. They're completely free from defilement, but they're who they are. Mm-hmm. It's like this great exchange in the in the suttas where it's toward the end of the Buddha's life, and Ananda comes to the Buddha and said, "There's this problem in the Sangha with some disruptive characters with wrong view, and they're living with Anuruddha, who's the Buddha's cousin, but the Anuruddha is the arhant who's foremost in knowledge of the different realms." I mean, he spent most of his time in the Deva realms rather than and Ananda's complaining that Anuruddha is not instructing or admonishing these monks that are with him. And the Buddha said, "Why would and this is paraphrasing, why would you expect Anuruddha to admonish or instruct them? He's never done that. Why would he do it now?" Bodhisattva practice? Well, I mean, in Theravada, it's not as overt as in the Mahayana. But in the Pali Canon, then it's always emphasized that, there's different ways of expressing your practice. One is for one's own benefit, one is for others' benefit, and one is for the benefit of both. And the Buddha always praises the practice which is of benefit to both, so that he also says there's practice of benefit denier as well. So that sense of that is that's lifted up and exalted as something that is very important in terms of application toward one's practice. And I see somebody like, all of these Ajahn Mahapur, Ajahn Man, Ajahn Lee, Ajahn Tate, Ajahn Cha, and these are incredible examples of people who are really selfless and give to the benefit of others. It was really one of the things that you both wanted to do and dreaded doing was being Ajahn Chah's attendant, because you wanted to do it because you wanted to be close to him, you wanted to experience his interactions with people, and to give to him. But then also, you dreaded it because you never knew when you were going to actually get to sleep. He never had a schedule. And people come at all times of day and night, and Ajahn Chah would receive them, he'd be there for them. So that if you were his attendant, then you were had to be there. And that was really hard work. You usually had to have a tag team of a couple different monks who were going to do it. To really be there for him, because he could give and give and give. So that it was both incredibly inspiring and also incredibly daunting. So yeah, Bodhisattva, somebody who gives for the benefit of others. There's also, I'd say, Ajahn Mahapur, known for his ferocity and because very demanding, very, very kind of push. And this is after I came to America. He was visiting Wat Nanachat International Monastery, and he was asked, because everybody accepts him, and he's considered to be a enlightened being, and somebody asked him, how do you put him? Sort of like, what are the mind states of an enlightened being like? Mm-hmm. And Ajahn Mahabhu didn't miss a beat, just came, only compassion. Mm-hmm. Everything was grounded in compassion. Mm-hmm. Because that's the first place that the heart goes to for an enlightened mind. So it's a so in the Theravada there's certainly within the Thai tradition the great teachers are beings that are beings of compassion and service they give.
What's the practice of meta practice
is related to compassion?
It's
related to compassion. Mm-hmm. In the Theravada, then there's probably more emphasis on loving kindness, on metta, than there is on mm-hmm. compassion. And a lot of it the way it was taught in the time of the Buddha is that the four divine abidings of metta, karuna, compassion, mudita, sympathetic joy, upekha, equanimity, those are a constellation of divine abidings. That's what it literally translates, Brahma-vihara, divine abidings. One of the teachers in our tradition translated it quite nicely as, in a modern vernacular, these are the four mature emotions. Mm-hmm. So this is what a mature being actually gravitates towards. But the quality of metta is considered the first doorway into those other qualities, and metta is, it's hard to translate into English. When it's translated into Thai, I think this gives a more of a feeling of what it's pointing to is a well wishing. Sort of like one wishes for the happiness and well-being mm-hmm. of others. Where it says that compassion is the wish to alleviate suffering. So that's how there's a differentiation. But it opens the doorway into that when we wish for the well-being of others, then it opens the doorway into that wish for their alleviation of suffering.
Yeah, I remember in the book, like Ajahn Amaro, he talked about compassion, practical metta. He talked about everything your mind contact with, for example, the sound, the taste, anything your mind encounters, you transform that kind of energy into a compassion and the metta is how is that?
Well, I think one of the things in terms of especially as a practice or as a training or as a result is that when we don't respond to, say, the sensory contact of the world outside with aversion, fear, ill will, suspicion, then you're able to shed the negative reactions, then it naturally sort of creates some space for a wholesome reaction. And the natural wholesome reaction when we're able to shed the sort of the negative habits would be to loving kindness and compassion.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that unskillful tendencies are transformed into the skillful and the wholesome.
You transfer all your negative reaction and emotion into the kindness, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, because the thing is it, especially if you come back to something reflecting on the Four Noble Truths, that and also reflecting on our own inherent tendencies, we prefer happiness. We prefer to be happy than to be miserable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just as oftentimes we don't see it clearly,
mm-hmm.
so then we get caught in the negative.
Mm-hmm.
We get caught in something unskillful. But when we see that more clearly, and when we see the benefit of responding in ways that create well-being,
mm-hmm.
loving kindness, compassion. Because that's the direct result of tending to say loving kindness is we experience happiness,
mm-hmm.
and we experience well-being. When we incline to compassion, and we experience well-being and happiness.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a vested interest.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also paying attention to those natural inclinations and tendencies, and being able to support the things that actually lead to well-being, and happiness, to peace.
What are those natural inclinations, for example?
Well, the natural result. The inclinations are just habits that we've cultivated, so that if the habit is one of fear, aversion,
mm-hmm.
ill will, then we start to transform those so that it becomes more natural to respond with loving kindness and compassion,
mm-hmm.
because the result inherently in those responses is one of happiness and well-being,
mm-hmm.
and it feels better.
Mm-hmm.
The Buddha teaching is to end the suffering, but you see, for cultivated people, they see the normal life, the ordinary life is people suffering those things. But from the ordinary people's view, the cultivating life is also a suffering life. You live without a house, living in the forest, and bite by those incense, and stay long, suffer the numbness, or maybe the ghost around. It's also a suffer. There is not the ending.
So
who is right?
Well, see, that's the thing is that I put my trust in the Buddha. I put my money on him. So that's where we have to experiment and investigate, and that's why the Buddha, you know, encourage that investigation. But it's also why You know, when we think of the Four Noble Truths are not a doctrine of belief, but they're experiential. So you start paying attention to the experience. So that the experience of, okay, you just think, oh God, my fear, I don't live out in the forest, and you don't have to walk up and down the hills, and you only get to eat, and this and everything. But then, you know, people really worry about coming here. And then they come, and say, oh, well, yeah, it feels good. So then you start saying, well, yeah, maybe I can do that. And then you start applying your mind to that, and you realize, oh, yeah, it has an effect. It's when we pay attention to the feeling of it is when we start to get more tangible results. It's like Ajahn Chah was once asked, how can you teach Westerners? Because you don't even speak English. And they can't speak Thai. And how can you teach them? And Ajahn Chah said, well, the teaching of the Buddha isn't about language. He said that language can be confusing. It's like when he picked up a glass of, he usually had some warm water beside him. So it's like this, you know, we call this warm water in English, but in Thai it's Nam Ron. And they don't, in Lao language it's Nam Hong. In Chinese it'd be something else. In French it'd be something else. And so language is not, you can't make things that clear. And he said, if you stick your finger in, then you know what warm water is. He said, and that's what the teachings of the Buddha are, not about language. So the teachings of the Buddha is a language of experience. We have to pay attention to what is it that leads to, what is the experience of suffering? What's the experience of happiness? What is its causes? This is experience. It's not a doctrine.